tonight. So we do not have a quorum. If I could get, if we could bring the testifiers up to the front. We'll start doing the presentation on the governor's recommendation for the Board of Animal Health that's first on the agenda.
What's that?
We do now officially have a quorum, so I'll officially call the meeting to order. Representative Green, have you had a chance to look over the minutes?
I have, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to move the minutes.
Representative Green moves the minutes, dated January 24th. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. So we have representation from the Board of Animal Health. If you please state your name for the record and begin. If you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Beth Thompson. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Animal Health and the State Veterinarian. Once again, on behalf of the Board of Animal Health, thank you for the opportunity to present the budget to you. I'm going to start out with a little bit of a synopsis of some of the information that we gave to you before. And I've also got our business manager here with me today, and he'll do some testifying at the end of the presentation about the budget. I have to say that Morgan's been in his position, Morgan Grelson has been in his position, I think a month or two longer than I have been in my position. So we're both seasoned professionals for this hearing.
Perfect.
At the Board of Animal Health, we always look back to our history first, and many times for legislative hearings, other meetings that we have, we like to talk about how the Board of Animal Health came to be in Minnesota back in the early 1900s. And it was because there was zoonotic diseases within the state of Minnesota, glanders, which we've got up on the screen right now, some information about that, respiratory disease of horses that was passed to humans, and tuberculosis, too, which was in the cattle population at that time, also which can pass to humans. One thing that we haven't talked about much, though, is research in Minnesota. And the Board of Animal Health really isn't a research agency. What we do is we partner with mainly the University of Minnesota. And going again back in history, back to right around 1903, 1904, they were doing tests for brucellosis. Again, zoonotic disease, it's a reproductive disease. And they were trying to work with the Department of Health for lab space to test for brucellosis. That worked out for 1 year, but the Department of Health raised their rates for that lab space, went up to $2,000 a year. So the Board of Animal Health looked to the University of Minnesota and recognized that the University of Minnesota as a land-grant college was perfect for doing research. And that was really the basis for the Board of Animal Health starting to work with the University of Minnesota here in the state of Minnesota. And I'll mention the University of Minnesota Diagnostic Lab a few times, too. But this last year, the university recognized the Board of Animal Health as a Research Partner of the Year. And it was really a proud moment for us. We don't actually do the research at the Board of Animal Health. We may have one of our veterinarians involved in some of the research, but truly the University of Minnesota, both the College of Vet Med and the Diagnostic Lab are important partners with the Board of Animal Health in discoveries related to animal disease. We do have a five-member board, our five-member board that's up on the screen right now. And starting from the left, we've got Paul Hanowski. He represents the poultry producers in the state. Then we have Dr. Graham Brayshaw. He is the newest appointee to our board. He works at Golden Valley Humane Society. Dean Compart is in the middle. He's a swine producer. He's also the president of the board at this point in time. Then second from the right is Dr. Matt Anderson, large animal veterinarian, and Peter Ripka is a far-right dairy producer up from the central part of the state. Our board members are appointed by the governor for a four-year term. The next slide for you is an organizational chart of our staff. If you look back through, and especially in the last 10 years, we're around 40 employees. Depending on what's going on with disease, we might add a few employees, but it usually goes back down. Right now, we're at 41 employees. The gold color on the charts, those are our field staff. We have 13 field staff, veterinarians, non-veterinarians located through the state. And then on the second column, Dale Lauer, that's our assistant director out at the Minnesota Poultry Testing Laboratory. So Dale, Shauna, Allison, Krista, those folks are our people out at the Minnesota Poultry Testing Lab. That Minnesota Poultry Testing Laboratory is a cooperative effort between the Board of Animal Health and the University of Minnesota. The testing part of the laboratory is important for the National Poultry Improvement Project, and then our poultry programs are also housed out in Wilmer. The new poultry lab out in Wilmer is really amazing. I think our poultry producers across the state are so appreciative of what the legislature did during HPAP avian influenza and the governor's office. Importantly for our work, and I did mention a little bit about the research and testing already, but is our partnership with the College of Veterinary Medicine, the diagnostic lab located here in St. Paul, but also that poultry testing laboratory out in Wilmer. Since the grand opening this last fall, the poultry testing laboratory, they run right around 6,500 tests per week. And there's been 800 PCR tests done since the grand opening. And the PCR test is that important test that they need to do for HPAP avian influenza. So there is certain surveillance testing that continues to be done on a weekly basis, and included in that is the avian influenza. Again, during HPAP avian influenza, if you were a poultry producer out in Kandy, Ojai County, or someplace west, your samples had to be driven into the lab in St. Paul. But because of the new lab and the addition out in Wilmer now, they can be tested out in Wilmer. And again, thank you for all the work on that very important project. A lot of what the board does starts out with detecting and controlling so that we can eradicate diseases. The picture up on your screen right now is some of our folks walking towards a turkey barn. You can see that biosecurity sign up on the right-hand side, disease control area, keep out. Detecting comes by, really starts with, our reportable diseases list. And I believe that may have been included in your packet for today. That list, by statute, the board has to have a list of reportable diseases. Those diseases are those diseases that are important to our livestock industries. They might be zoonotic diseases. But really those diseases that we go to our producers and veterinarians and make sure that we have them on the list. If you look across all states, they probably have very similar reportable diseases lists. In addition, that detection, it comes from our producers and veterinarians. We can smile about it now, but I can tell you when the first case of highly pathogenic avian influenza was thought to be happening out in Polk County, the person that was called was our assistant director, Dale Lauer. And over 100 cases later, throughout that whole summer, I can tell you that probably 75% of those cases, prior to samples being taken, the producer or the veterinarian called Dr. Dale Lauer. And that is so important that people at the Board of Animal Health, both in the St. Paul office, our field staff, out in Wilmer, we have that relationship with our producers and veterinarians. We pick up the phone when the phone call comes in. The control part of detecting, control, and eradicating is both active and passive. We are out on a yearly basis inspecting and permitting livestock markets. We inspect and permit all of the fairs. Anytime there's a commingling of animals, livestock, we are usually involved with that. And then we go back out there during the fair. We have people that go to a lot of the livestock markets on a weekly basis and watch what's going on within those markets. That's part of that control effort. And then in addition to that, of course, ongoing relationships. Import standards and animal movement, also important for what we do at the Board of Animal Health. Really, all livestock species have some sort of import standard for those species to come into the state of Minnesota, whether it be official identification, They need to send their movement records into the Board of Animal Health. And importantly, you know, if they're coming from an area where there might be a disease, and we think about brucellosis maybe out in Montana or Wyoming, some of those diseases, then they aren't allowed in. All of that information is held at the Board of Animal Health. For example, cattle records in this last fiscal year, we've tracked 163,000 individual animal IDs on cattle coming into the state. In addition to that, we've tracked 131,000 unique IDs at the markets within the state of Minnesota. It's so important if you get notification, which we have in the past few years. A good example is tuberculosis. Cattle had moved in from herds in Michigan and herds in Texas, and a few years later it was discovered that those herds were infected with tuberculosis. Because of the records, we could track those animals that were here in the state of Minnesota, and the appropriate testing was done. So all of that goes into not only the import standards and animal movement, but tracking of disease, which is what the base of the Board of Animal Health is.
Excuse me, Dr. Thompson. We do have a question. Chair Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. The tracking, doctor, is that done on the cattle with a simple ear tag or a brand, or how do you specifically track cattle?
Dr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, with cattle, we are not a brand state. We do recognize brands in certain situations. It's in certain circumstances, but it's really the official identification that goes into the ear. There is national identification methods. NOOS is a National Uniform Ear Tagging System is one type of those methods. We know if you send out a series of tags, say 1 through 100, to a certain producer, to a certain vet clinic, we track that. And then on the back end, we also track sightings of animals when they are at markets or are tested.
All right, thank you. Please continue.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, another slide on emergency planning and preparedness. In this past fiscal year, we've tracked one bovine vesicular case, one cervid case, a case of ORF or a parapox case, a canine case, two avian mortality events, which happened not to be high path avian influenza, but there was high mortality, and we investigated. And then we've tracked 105 swine vesicular cases. I've probably talked about this before, but there is a disease right now in swine that looks exactly like foot and mouth disease. So every time a case is reported to the board, we have to do a foreign animal disease investigation. Our folks are sent out there. We take samples. The samples go to the national lab, and then we wait and hold those animals until they're cleared of any foreign animal disease case. These potentially disastrous diseases that the board tracks really fall into five or six different categories. They're important for public health, animal agriculture, food safety, and also our economic prosperity. A lot of times they fall into all of those different categories. Rapid detection and tracing is imperative in these cases. And right now up on the screen I've got a picture of, again, a biosecurity sign. And then the gentleman on the right is one of our district vets going through the procedure to, well, clean your boots after you've been on a farm when you're doing an investigation. The board uses science and risk assessment, those basic management practices, for what it does when we are dealing with a disease. We communicate up to the federal level because USDA Veterinary Services, sometimes Wildlife Services, is involved. But we also communicate out and work with state agencies, stakeholder groups, and again, the individual producers and veterinarians. Hand in hand with the emergency planning and preparedness, though, is that business continuity piece. And if you remember back to high path avian influenza, there was an infected premises, and then a circle was drawn around that infected premises. All of those businesses within that circle had to continue to do business. And that's the piece that goes hand in hand with emergency planning. So there are secure supply plans for eggs, turkeys, broilers, and then there's also beef, pork, and milk that have secure supply plans, keeping business going when there's a disease emergency. This is part of the public, private, and again, University of Minnesota, both the College of Vet Med and the Diagnostic Lab. We all work together on these diseases. And again, everything that the board does is really related to responding to disease events. And with that, I think I'll turn it over to Mr. Grelson, if that's okay, Chair.
Mr. Grelson, please state your name for the record, who you represent, and begin.
Mr. Chair, committee members, good morning. My name is Morgan Grelson, and I am the business manager for the Board of Animal Health. I'm going to provide an overview of our budget. So the slide that you're seeing right now is the governor's recommended budget for fiscal year 18. And as a little background information, in 2016, as part of our general fund, there was the additional $1,853,000 that was allocated for the avian influenza emergency preparedness and response work that needed to be done. Last year, that was it was broadened so that we can utilize those funds at the board for any disease emergency response or planning. And so that is part of the general fund then moving forward into fiscal year 18. And as with most budgets, as you know, the majority, usually 60 to 70%, are salary and benefits. And so our budget is no different going to fiscal year 18. Contracted vendors, Dr. Thompson mentioned the relationship that we have with the University of Minnesota, and so they do great work, and we have contracts with them to do testing and provide those results back to us. The governor's proposed budget has an additional $59,000 allocated for us for fiscal year 18, and $107,000 additional dollars for fiscal year 19, and that's to help us maintain our services and you know, meet the increased costs of FICA, health insurance, that kind of thing. On the next slide, I should also mention the carry forward or the move forward amount of $675,000. And so, as I mentioned, with the emergency preparedness work that we're doing, we're looking at using those funds through June of 2019, so we can continue with the development and implementation of the emergency preparedness work that's already begun. The fiscal year 19, as I mentioned.
Mr. Grelson, on the contract vendors, would it be possible to get a list of those contract vendors? And then also, are there any chargebacks between departments? Are there any other departments that, I guess I'm calling them chargebacks, whether it's the Attorney General or anything like that, that transfer monies in between the departments? You could provide that, too.
Mr. Chair, committee members, yes, I'll get each of our contracts a brief description on the amounts for each of those contracts. In addition, yes, we have an arrangement with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and so there are funds that go to support the staff that they assign to work with us, for example, with human resources. They do a lot of our human resource work with us, and they are incurring the cost. So we're reimbursing them for those types of costs.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. So the fiscal year 19 budget, as the governor has recommended, again, as I mentioned, $107,000 additional dollars are being recommended for the the continued increase or expected increase for primarily costs related to staffing, but there's also increased costs for testing. The University of Minnesota certainly has increased costs that we need to recognize. So again, it's to maintain, primarily to maintain the current level of service and work that we're doing at this point. And then just the $35,000 that you'll note is to be carried forward into fiscal year 2020 is our indemnity money that we have the authority to carry forward for payments for any cattle that would need to be euthanized due to tuberculosis.
Thank you.
Are there any questions, or will you be also walking through in our folders here? We do, I don't know, do they have a copy of the expenditures by fund? Okay. So, or maybe that's a question for Ms. Place. As far as going through the, are you wanting to walk through the governor's recommendations, the expenditures overviews per department by line item?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Whitney Place with the Department of Agriculture. So our intention was going to be to start walking through our divisions, and then probably on Tuesday after we get through all of our divisions, we'll go through the documents included in the governor's budget.
Okay. Thank you. That'll work. So any other questions then for the testifiers? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Thompson, for all you do and your testimony. I'm curious, you know, a lot of the testimony is about kind of dealing with emergencies, and does the Board of Animal Health deal with kind of long-term health of the herds in Minnesota?
Dr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, there are in place different programs that look at long-term disease issues, such as if you refer to the list of reportable diseases. Hang on a minute. Some of the diseases, such as Yoni's disease, which is a paratuberculosis in cattle, we have worked with producers for probably at least two decades in that disease, and it's not a disease that has risen to the livestock industries. It's significant, and we need to eradicate it position yet, but certainly ongoing, doing education with the producers of how to keep yonis out of your herd or how to get it out of your herd if you have it. It's one example. There are other examples in the poultry. I'm trying to think on the hog side. Certainly when porcine epidemic diarrhea virus was introduced into the United States, the need for increased biosecurity, the need to do certain things on hog farms, ongoing biosecurity efforts. Yes, I would say there are long-term health issues, usually, though, related to a specific disease.
Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. My thinking was along the lines of, you know, we're seeing increasing amount of nitrates in wells across Minnesota, and we know the focus is always on the impact of that on small children and that sort of thing. But are you aware, do nitrates have any impact on the overall health of the animals? And do they impact not only the health, but possibly the productivity of these animals? Have you looked at that, or do you know if nitrates impact animals in some way similar to how they impact young children?
Dr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, there is information out there on the impact of nitrates to animals. Unfortunately, by statute, the Board of Animal Health does deal specifically with diseases. I'm not aware of any cross-research talking about the effect of nitrates and then the effect of disease on top of each other. That might be a better question maybe for, somebody in the Department of Ag or maybe Pollution Control Agency when they look at nitrates.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, again, it's not clear where that focus would be. I'll ask the Department of Agriculture when they come on. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Thompson and Mr. Grelson, I want to make sure that we take this opportunity. I want to thank you for the work that the Board of Animal Health does. I've gotten to know you quite well because of the High Path Avian last year, some of the other work that you've done in Wilmer. And, Mr. Chair, I want to tell you that from a member who has been very critical of many different departments in the state of Minnesota, this is a department that gets it right. And they understand their role. They do it very well. They do it efficiently, and they understand the people that they're serving. So I just want to make sure that you're publicly thanked. You did a lot of grueling work last year in particular, but I know you do a lot of grueling work that doesn't necessarily make the news the rest of the year. And so just thank you very much. I just wanted to be able to say that.
Thank you for those comments, Representative Miller. Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, Doctor, I understand you do also deal with small animals in your agency, is that right?
Dr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, members, yes, I do. We all do at the board. We're really cross-trained. Dr. Paul Anderson is the person that heads up the kennel program and also the dog and cat breeder program, but we really do, we're cross-trained is what I'd like to say.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, one of the reasons I ask is I looked at the list of reportable diseases, and I noticed that under zoonotic diseases of public health significance, or no, it's the one above, vector-borne diseases of public health significance, you specifically point out that it does not cover Lyme disease. And one of the reasons, what is the reason for that?
Dr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, when we put our list of reportable diseases together, we really look to our public health veterinarian, who is housed in the Department of Health, for information on those diseases. So the reason that Lyme disease isn't in there would be a question for the public health veterinarian.
Mr. Chairman, Clark. Is the public health veterinarian here? Going to be testifying or available? Or?
No, they're not here.
They're not here. Okay.
They're not here, Representative Clark.
Okay, Mr. Chairman. Well, maybe I can just give you the question to take back to that person. So one of the things that we know about Lyme disease is that small animals do get Lyme disease, and they get Lyme-related disease from the same tick that transmit Lyme disease. There's several, I think, two or three different ones that mimic or are very similar. And one of the reasons that's a problem more and more, I mean, we have quite an epidemic of Lyme disease in Minnesota from what I understand. Small animals like dogs, for example, who travel back and forth to areas of high infestation of Lyme disease, and I can speak very personally about this, and then come back to maybe city or metropolitan areas, they're bringing back with them the ticks that then are become a problem in throughout the state. And I know we had a discussion the other day about whether or not Lyme disease or ticks occurred in the metropolitan area. They do. I can tell you my own dog has brought them back and forth. And you know, even with a lot of care of trying to always remove them, we now have backyards in our urban areas that have tick infestations. And so it's not just an issue of greater Minnesota anymore. And I just wanted to ask if we could have some follow-up on that, because this is a very serious public health issue. You know, chronic Lyme disease is something we're learning more and more about. You know, long-term life, long life impacts. So I would like to actually see if that might be something that our board might take a look at and just try to, have some more understanding of it. Thank you.
Dr. Thompson, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, and certainly if it is becoming an issue, generally the diseases on the reportable disease list are foreign animal diseases, or there are some diseases that specific groups have come to the board and said, we need this on the reportable diseases list. And a good example of that is equine herpes myeloencephalopathy. That has just been, I think it's been on the list now for 3 years, because the equine community came to the board and said, we need to have this reported. So I will certainly take that up with Dr. Chantel.
Appreciate that.
Representative Clark? Okay. Any other questions for the testifiers, members? Seeing none, I want to thank you for the overview. And Ms. Place, would you like to move to the front? And also thank you for the clarification, too, on what we're going to do as far as diving into the numbers here. So,
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Poppy.
Mr. Chair, just as they're kind of doing the transition here, if I could do something else. I made a snarky comment, and I apologize for that, at our last meeting, to Mr. Tom Peterson regarding him not providing any cupcakes for his birthday. So I apologize publicly here. And so my intention was, and maybe I would bring cupcakes today, but I have the good fortune of representing, you know, I talk about Austin being Spamtown USA because I represent the good people at Hormel who do make Spam and other things. But one of their recent acquisitions was Skippy Peanut Butter. And I had a visit from the government affairs person from Hormel this week, and he brought along some PB Bites. So those are some little snackable items, and so I'm going to distribute those, but it really is an honor of Tom Peterson for his birthday. But I want to give due credit here to Hormel because they're the ones that are providing these. So I'm going to have they come in little jars, so you can just take out from the jars. And there are two different kinds. These are their latest versions. So one is with graham crackers and one is with granola. I apologize if you have a peanut allergy because you probably wouldn't want to be taking these. But so if you want to, you can open them and take some out just to sample them. And I'll get these distributed to people in the audience as well. So anyway, that was my little spiel. And I get to talk about my town, too, and the good people that are working at Hormel. Thank you.
Representative Poppy, you are way too kind. Mr. Peterson, you got off way too easily. Way too easy. So, right. Well, thank you. Thank you for doing that, Representative Poppy. Ms. Place? Oh, Commissioner, welcome back. State your name for the record and begin, please.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matt Woolman. I serve as Deputy Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. It's great to be back, and today we are before your committee to provide you with a more detailed overview of the department's work. And over the rest of this hearing, and I understand the next hearing, we're going to give you an overview of the divisions within the department and the work that we do. And also at the end, we will give you an overview of the governor's budget recommendation, a detailed overview of where our money goes and what we're buying. In general, agriculture is a cornerstone of Minnesota's economy. $90 billion in economic activity, incredibly important to our state in terms of jobs. 340,000 jobs are created as a result of agriculture in Minnesota. We have 73,600 family farms across our state, and the average size of our farms are 352 acres, relatively modest in size on average. Agriculture in Minnesota is successful because of the diversity of our economy here in the state. We rank fifth in crop production and seventh in the nation in livestock production. And many of our commodities, including turkeys and hogs, soybeans, corn, rank well in the top tier of states across the country. We're also home to some leading food and agribusiness companies in Minnesota. We have seven companies that are listed on the Fortune 500 list. We also have a number of companies on the Forbes list of largest private companies in the country. And we have a whole host of other smaller private and public companies that serve agriculture and agribusiness in our state. Trade is absolutely critical to Minnesota's economy. Our total annual exports are about $6.3 billion on average. I've kind of accounted how that breaks down. Soybeans are our top exported crop, $1.6 million dollars worth. Corn, $1.3 million. Pork, it ranks right up there as well as wheat. Minnesota ag exports generate about $8.7 billion when you account for total business activities, so transportation and other types of things. And is responsible for about 46,000 of those 340,000 jobs in Minnesota. Our top export markets include China, Canada, and Mexico, as well as a number of other companies. The Asian Pacific countries serve as the largest growth for agricultural opportunities. And obviously, we've had strong relations with Canada and Mexico, who are solid trade partners for Minnesota ag products. Overall, trends in Minnesota agriculture and food production, consumers are increasingly interested where their food is coming from, how it's being raised. They have strong expectations for a safe food supply. We have, you know, consumers that are more focused on the environment and how their food is being raised. There's certainly in Minnesota a growing local and organic food sector. We see growth in international trade, particularly opportunities in the Asian Pacific countries. We're seeing the emergence of new biofuels and bioproducts, adding value to our different commodities. And we're also seeing stronger interest in from consumers about where their food comes from. In general, our mission at the department is to enhance the quality of life for Minnesotans by ensuring the integrity of our food supply, the health of our environment, and the strength of our ag economy. And we do this in multiple ways. We do this by, you know, being the primary state agency responsible for protecting the state's food supply and being a key player in protecting our natural resources. We're also the primary agency responsible for supporting and promoting Minnesota ag industry and economy across the globe. Overall, our funding sources are varied. So we have 42% of our budget is general fund, 36% is dedicated or user fee based. About 15% is federal funding, so from USDA or FDA, for example, and 7% is Clean Water Legacy dollars that go into specific programs. Overall, the structure of the agency, we have, you know, as you can see, the two columns going down, we have the regulatory side of the agency and the promotion side of the agency, our ag marketing and development division, plant protection. We have dairy and meat inspection, food and feed safety, pesticide and fertilizer management, and our laboratory services, and then our administrative functions and our finance, the Rural Finance Authority. So today we're going to start diving into each of these divisions and giving you some additional overview of the work that we do. And first up is Mr. Chair, if you're so inclined, Paul Huguenin, who is our section supervisor for our Ag Marketing and Development Division, will give you an overview of that division.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, and begin, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Paul Huguenin. I'm a section supervisor in the Ag Marketing and Development Division.
Welcome.
The Ag Marketing and Development Division is a little bit different than much of the Department of Agriculture in that we are not a regulatory division. Our role is to work in partnership with Minnesota farmers, agribusinesses, and our job is to help those folks promote the production, processing, and marketing of Minnesota food, fiber, feed, and fuel. If you look at our division, you can basically break our services out into three broad categories: production assistance, market access and business development, and then education and ag literacy. So in the area of production assistance, this is where we get into areas like working with livestock producers to help them with livestock facility siting around the state, connecting retiring farmers with new producers, and working with dairy farmers and with projects like our dairy business planning grants and our dairy development teams. As you heard in last week's biofuels presentation, clearly this division has a strong emphasis on promoting the production and the use of biofuels and bio-based products. We also provide technical assistance to producers on a whole variety of issues ranging from organic certification as well as the use of integrated pest management techniques as a tool that can help reduce the use of pesticides on specialty crops. One of our larger areas is the area of market access. And in this area, we work all across the spectrums of markets, ranging from small town farmers markets with a handful of vendors to companies who are marketing internationally and exporting products ranging from commodities to processed food products. On the local market, the Minnesota Grown Directory continues to be a very popular tool for Minnesotans to buy locally and connect with their farmers. More than 1,000 listings in the directory, and it ranges the gamut from pick-your-own farms to garden centers, Christmas tree growers, to livestock producers who are selling quarters and halves of beef directly to the consumer. On a larger scale, the domestic market. So part of what we do is we coordinate Minnesota pavilions. So pavilions of Minnesota companies at large domestic shows like the National Restaurant Association show in Chicago or the Natural Products Expo show in Anaheim, California. And part of the reason behind putting together these pavilions is we're able to secure prime space in these large shows as a way to help companies enter those markets, increase their visibility to the marketplace, and to be able to co-locate with other Minnesota companies. Now, part of the benefit that comes with that is that we're creating an environment of networking among these companies, and it creates informal mentorship opportunities. That's part of the role we can play in what's really becoming a very exciting food entrepreneurship climate here in the state of Minnesota. And it's fun to see these companies, these entrepreneurs with new ideas have success on a national scale, and we're proud to play a small part in that. On the international level with exports, part of what we do is similar to the strategy we have domestically, where we can put together pavilions of Minnesota companies at shows all over the globe, ranging from Dubai to Scandinavia. And that provides direct access and sales opportunities for specific companies. But with exports, part of what we're doing is a much more longer-term approach where it's about developing relationships. And so from that standpoint, the department is hosting trade missions to foreign countries. So in 2015, there was the trip to Cuba, for example, hosting reverse missions where foreign buyers will come here as well.
Excuse me, we do have a question. Chair Anderson?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I could have waited. But on a previous slide, I noticed that Canada and Mexico were our second and third largest export destinations. And with the NAFTA treaty evidently going away, what are you hearing? What are you thinking? What's going to happen to exports from Minnesota?
Mr. Dugan.
Mr. Chair and members, probably the best way I can answer that is to say that's a really good question. And I'm not sure that I'm the right guy to answer that. I think probably the best approach would be for me to go back, talk to some of our folks, put together some information, and provide that at a later date. For me to speculate on that, I think, would put me on some really thin ice. I often tell companies, they'll ask, you know, guidance about, hey, should we go into this market or that market? And I always tell them, I'm probably not the guy you want to go to for your entrepreneurial advice about how you're going to invest your savings. But we'd be happy to do some looking and come back.
Thank you, Chair Anderson.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, if I could add, you know, NAFTA is a huge component to our agricultural economy here, and we're very, very concerned at the Department of Agriculture about that.
All right. Please continue.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members.
I'm sorry. Rep. Sumhan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And following up on that, you know, I just read that the Mexican president canceled his trip to the to meet with the president, and you know, the figures that you were mentioning in terms of trade, and the biggest one, I think, was China. So not just NAFTA, but TPP. So you may not be able to speculate, but if we look at these numbers here in terms of how much we're selling, it's pretty significant. And how would we start to see a backlash? Would it be companies contacting you, or would you be hearing from our companies, or would you be hearing from other countries about concerns?
Mr. Hugan?
Mr. Chair and members, in our case, our staff would tend to hear from a couple of different types of people. So we'd hear from individual companies who are either already marketing to a given country or a given region, or we would be hearing from commodity groups who are looking at commodity on a larger scale in terms of corn, soybean meal. So that's where we would hear information. One of the things about our international program within the Department of Agriculture I think is important is that we do work closely with DEED, and we collaborate with DEED. In fact, our lead international staff person started his career at Department of Agriculture helping agricultural companies, and then moved to DEED and spent many years on their staff. And so we have a very positive relationship, and so we can collaborate in terms of information sharing and contacts.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if we had a trade war or trade impact, and if we also see the renewable fuel standard frozen, or that's, I think that was on the list of rules to be wiped out, that would be pretty significant for Minnesota agriculture, correct?
Mr. Hugan.
Chair members, without a doubt, export markets are a critical market for Minnesota farmers and Minnesota food processors, Hormels of the world, et cetera. Our companies are, you know, you saw the list of Fortune 500 companies headquartered here in Minnesota, and global marketing is a key part of the portfolio for most of those folks. So the questions that you're asking, Representative, certainly are of prime importance to Minnesota's economy, particularly Minnesota's agricultural economy.
Representative Hansen. Okay. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this trade will be an interesting progression over the next year. Not only does it affect our agriculture, but the trade war is also going on with Target and a couple of our other big companies, so it will be worth watching. And having said that, you've talked about what you do for trade and how you put on marketing expos or whatever, or attend them. Could you explain to me what you do in terms of your trade promotion with the Minnesota Trade Office?
Ms. Buchanan.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members, so a good example of collaborating with the trade office would be, for example, if you have a governor's level trade mission where it's not just an agricultural mission. So sometimes there are agricultural missions led by our commissioner. The Cuba mission was one of those examples. But in the case of, say, a Mexican governor's level trade mission, the trade office takes the lead in organizing that. They will come to us, collaborate with us in terms of, okay, so who from the agricultural community would like to attend and what kinds of meetings. We'll set up a parallel set of special meetings for the agricultural folks. So with Mexico, we had folks from the Dairy Council, corn and soybeans. And so we will at times split off, have specific meetings for that group of folks. And then there are other meetings that are joint meetings with the whole delegation meeting on a broader level. So hopefully that gets a little bit at kind of a specific example of how we can collaborate with them.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How often do you collaborate with them? I mean, is the state spends a lot of money to support those particular offices. Mm-hmm. Do you collaborate with them on trade once a year, once a week?
Mr. Hugan.
Mr. Chair, members, I can tell you that we have a very frequent set of communications with them. So, for example, the trade office may host educational workshops. If they're a workshop that has value to an agricultural community, we will collaborate with those folks on that, make that a joint activity. There are times when, for example, the trade office has a more detailed protocol office and expertise. So there are certain events where, for example, it's very sensitive in terms of how might one arrange the flags behind the podium or how might one address a representative from a country, et cetera. And so we don't duplicate that set of services. So my staff person will coordinate with them very closely. So short answer to your question is we are in almost constant contact with them. Another specific example that might get at your question even more direct, there are certain federal programs that DEED will apply for, and we will collaborate with them, and it's routine for them to write us in as a part. So they may have a broader federal application for funds to develop export markets, but we will work with them to carve out a component of that that's specific to agricultural interests. That's the kind of a relationship that we have with DEED. Collaborative, non-duplicative. Our statutory authority is on the agricultural products, but we play nicely together.
Representative Mahoney.
Question. At some point, could you forward to me the budget that you spend on trade promotion?
Mr. Hugin.
Mr. Chair, members, absolutely.
Same question absolutely. I asked of the DEED trade office, so I'm not trying to pick on anybody here.
Absolutely. Hugin. We'd be happy to do that.
All right. Thank you. Please continue.
I just want to give one example on the export thing that I think is really timely and relevant. So this fall, we coordinated a mission to go to Scandinavia, and the point of that was for us to introduce our soybean folks to the large, massive fish farming operations in Scandinavia. Aquaculture is potentially a large market for Minnesota soybeans and Minnesota soybean meal, and so we took some of the folks from the Soybean Council over there to see firsthand what do these sites look like, to meet some of the principles behind those businesses and to explore, can our soybean farmers capitalize on those opportunities? In terms of business development, clearly the AGRI, which is Agricultural Growth Research and Innovation Grant Program, AGRI, clearly that's the centerpiece of our business development efforts. A couple of examples of how those grants come into play. The livestock investment grants provide a very key piece of financial assistance that encourages the expansion of livestock facilities around the state, but that also help livestock farmers begin to transition so that the next generation of farmers can begin to enter that business in a livestock enterprise. Value-added grant program is another grant program that exists to help Minnesota processors add value to what we grow and raise in Minnesota, to also help farmers who wish to value add their own products as well. And this grant program helps provide equipment so that we can modernize and expand processing facilities around the state. One key market segment that we have worked with closely on this and kind of identified as a priority is Minnesota's meat processing industry. All the data tells us that an awful lot of the owners of meat processing plants all over the state of Minnesota are rapidly nearing retirement age. And so it's critical that these facilities are upgraded and that people who want to buy one of those facilities can upgrade it, make the necessary improvements so that they can be profitable for another generation of owners. Some of these businesses are so important to Main Street Minnesota and communities of all sizes. We need to make sure that industry stays here, and we've been able to help well over a dozen meat processing plants purchase equipment and upgrade facilities. The third kind of unique component of that I wanted to give a couple of examples of is the Farm to School Grant Program. Now, that's a really small part of the AGRI portfolio, but we think it plays an important role, and a couple of examples would be we partner very closely with Midwest Dairy. And the idea behind that is to help schools be able to put in the equipment that they can purchase and serve more milk and milk-based products to students across Minnesota. One example is Winona School District, which put in a frozen yogurt machine. And the idea behind that is to give high school students a healthy alternative for a snack that meets all the nutrition standards, but it also allows for a bigger market for a product that obviously is very important to Southeast Minnesota. Second example would be Owatonna School District, where they are working directly with a turkey producer in Cannon Falls. They needed more cold storage so that they could buy larger quantities so that that farmer didn't have to deliver multiple times a week. So just a couple examples of how that farm-to-school program is making a difference. A little bit about education and ag literacy. We're really proud to be the home of the Minnesota Ag in the Classroom program. That's been a key part of what we do for many years at the department. Ag in the Classroom works closely with the Minnesota Ag in the Classroom Foundation to develop the Minnesota Ag Mag, which is targeted at kids in grades 4 through 6, and the newer publication, the Ag Mag Junior, which is targeted at a younger audience of first grade. All of the materials that Minnesota Ag in the Classroom program develops fit the grad standards in Minnesota. So the idea is to make sure that we're working with teachers, giving them information that fits the grad standards so that they can include them in class. Something really, I think, valuable that our staff does is to conduct trainings of teachers. So last year they had over 850 teachers that were trained in ag literacy, so either pre-service teachers or in-service teachers. And so getting direct contact with teachers so we can help them incorporate that into the curriculum.
Mr. Buchanan, we'll spend about 7 more minutes. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of performance measures to share. In terms of reaching out to the general public and consumers, the Minnesota Ag in the Classroom program that I just mentioned, nearly 50% of the state's elementary schools and middle schools are now getting ag literacy information from that program, which is an exciting milestone to approach. You heard Commissioner Wollman mention the Minnesota Grown program as a way to reach customers, consumers who want to buy locally. Over 308,000 people used our website last year to find local farms and farmers markets. The spoiler alert for the next update we give you the next time we do an update is that numbers continued to go up this past year as well. So that interest continues. Production assistance and technical assistance. Minnesota Organic Conference remains one of our most popular events. Well over 600 farmers and processors attend that to learn about the possibility of farming organically and sharing information. I talked about the aging ownership of many meat processing plants. Obviously, that mirrors agriculture as a whole. And so our folks have developed a FarmLink web tool where if you're a farmer that's looking to transition out, you can go on, you can list your property. If you're a farmer that wants, if you want to get into farming, you're looking for land to start your own farm, you can go on there and we can help start facilitating those relationships. The last piece of highlights is just two quick things about the Agri program. Leveraging private dollars is a key part of this program. So that appropriation leverages over $60 million of private investment a year. The livestock investment grant alone, we had 118 livestock investment grants to livestock producers in the last fiscal year, of which 100 of those were beginning farmers. And so, again, a tool to help folks enter that market. And just one final note to kind of give you the broad overview. Our division has about 38 full-time equivalents, so not the biggest division in the department, not the smallest, 38 FTEs, biennial budget of approximately $66 million. The majority of that is general fund dollars. The next biggest part of that, the general fund dollars, includes the agri appropriation. The ag fund is the next biggest part of that. And then we also have, in the next biennium, projecting just under $11 million of federal dollars in terms of our budget. With that, Mr. Chair and members, thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thank you. We do have a couple questions. Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have to comment on your comment about helping local meat markets expand, upgrade, to pass on to the next generation. I've talked to a couple of local markets that because of the additional regulations and having to spend money on cement floors and things like that to upgrade, they thought about going out of business. So I hope you kind of balance that with what you do in terms of upgrading to pass them on.
Mr. Hugan.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm glad you brought that question up. In fact, we have a priority in terms of our point system and scoring system. So if there's a food safety issue that those plants are trying to come into compliance with, that they get extra points in that. They already get some extra points for being a meat plant. We work closely with our meat inspection folks, and we encourage the plant in that case to provide have a letter come along with their app that says, my inspector is telling me we need to or should do this to comply with X. That really helps, and those folks, yeah, they definitely move to the top of the list, so to speak.
Sure.
Great question.
All right.
No, thanks again, Mr. Chair. Just that comment that we have to balance and use some common sense when trying to help some of these businesses stay in business. And yet be safe, too. I agree with that.
Thank you. Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, we were talking a little bit earlier about the impact of some of the emerging federal policies on trade. And I'm just wondering, yesterday we heard more about the intentions and actual executive orders for affecting our new American immigrants and refugees. And I know that in the agricultural sector, we have a lot of those folks who are working in production facilities. And I'm just wondering, are you looking at those numbers, tracking any of that right now? What can you tell us about what you do know about? We've heard from some of the producers directly, their deep concerns, but I'm just wondering if as an agency, you're also looking at that.
Ms. Place?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, our Division Director for the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division might be able to cover some of the concerns we have with the freeze on some federal grants. At the federal level, do you have a response to that?
Representative Clark.
I wasn't talking about pesticides. I'm talking about people who are working in production facilities. And so we know, for example, our milk producers, some of our, I'm sure Hormel and some of our other major producers in the state have a lot of employees who will be impacted by what we heard yesterday as an executive order. And I'm just, I guess if you're not looking at it, well, I guess I'd ask you to look at that and come back to us with some information on what that impact might be.
Mr. Chair, we will follow up.
Thank you. Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned programs working with Minnesota schools, and it made me think of something kind of along those lines. Are there any are schools required or encouraged to buy Minnesota products for the school lunch program, milk and other products when available?
Mr. Chair and members, that's a great question. At this point, there's no statutory requirement, for example, that schools have a local preference in bids. There's nothing that exists like that. I think that's a conversation that's come before the legislature in the past and been debated, but there's nothing on the books like that. So our grant program is a way to provide a different form of incentive for schools to do that. So when schools say, we would like to work with our local farmers, but gosh, we don't have cooler space, or in the case of turkeys, it's not efficient for them to make those deliveries. We can help them with equipment. The other thing we can do that's not equipment for schools, if they're at a point where a district says we need to evaluate our district facilities to identify what are the bottlenecks that prevent us from buying more local products, we can fund a district feasibility study. These are usually really inexpensive, but they can get their arms around what's stopping us from buying more local produce, and then they can come back and say, this is the piece of equipment we need.
Representative Juergens.
Thank you. So no requirements, but you definitely have some programs in place to help encourage that. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Next is Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Chair Anderson. Having suffered a couple of foodborne viruses, whatever you can do to increase food safety in this state, you got my vote. And whether it's a regulation or whatever, and however you help them do that, I won't graphically describe it, but just imagine the worst day of your life and uncomfortableness. So anyhow, my two questions here. You mentioned the leverage that the Agri program does. I didn't hear it, and then I've got one other. So what do you leverage with the Agri program? I think you said $60 million, but I'm not sure I heard that correctly.
Mr. Hugan.
Mr. Chair and members, so a couple of examples. So the livestock investment program, which I mentioned a couple of times, we provide 10% of what the total cost is. So the farmer themselves is coming up with 90% of that upgrade to facilities. if you look at Agri as a whole, that investment of $10.235 million is leveraging over $60 million of private investment. So
that's what I was at. Looking for.
Sorry. Thank you.
Mr. Mahoney.
One other question. You seem to talk, and I've heard it in the committee a number of times, the aging population in rural Minnesota and farms and food. Do you do succession planning? Do you help farmers and anyone in the food industry succession planning at all? And is that a line item in your budget? How much is it?
Mr. Hugin.
Mr. Chairman and members, conducting succession planning is not one of the things that we actually conduct. What we do in that case is we try to use our website, for example, as a clearinghouse so that we can, if a farmer is interested in that, we can have links to either different organizations who can provide those services. For example, some of the commodity groups have had workshops for their members where they'll bring in speakers, whether that's estate planners, attorneys, et cetera. So we don't provide that service, but we try to make it easy for farmers to access it from private or nonprofit folks who can deliver it.
Representative Mahoney?
Mr. Chair, this is to you. You might want to look at something like that. I know over in the Economic Development Committees, they actually, not actually in a line item, but many of the business assistance programs have that as a real piece, and they don't just do seminars, which are wonderful things. But they actually have a list of people who help do that, and they provide that to companies, and they have when they go out and talk to them, how's this succession planning going? Where are you at in that? You don't have to quit now today, but you're like 92 years old. You might want to think about it. How do you want to hand this off to your children? So taxes and regulations and all the other stuff. So something for you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Mahoney. The other thing, too, as far as your opening comment, the bill that we passed last legislative session, we had a strong focus on food safety, and I believe we allocated monies and resources to bring on about 40 FTEs to address that so we can meet our statutory requirements. So thank you for the comments. Any other questions for the testifiers? Seeing none, I want to thank you, and Ms. Place.
Mr. Chair, next up we have our Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division, and our Division Director, Josh Stamper, will be giving you an overview of that.
All right, thank you. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and begin, please.
Mr. Chair, my name is Joshua Stamper. I'm the Division Director for the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division in the Minnesota Department of Agriculture.
Welcome.
I'd like to start talking a little bit about what our division does within the agency. In the business of food production, we're constantly assailed by pests and diseases, and oftentimes through chemical and biological issues, shortages of plant nutrients. Our organization is responsible for the regulation of fertilizers and pesticides, but then we also have subsequent responsibility through the Groundwater Protection Act to protect our water resources from agricultural chemicals. Our organization is responsible for emergency response to spills and cleanups. We also conduct a waste pesticide collection program that over the last 25 years has collected about 7 million pounds of waste pesticides. We're also the division that's responsible for the Minnesota Ag Water Quality Certification Program. To date, that program has certified 327 farms that encompass a total of about 188,000 acres. And over those 188,000 acres, we've instituted 555 new conservation practices. This is probably one of our more high-demand programs. Currently, there is a queue of about 350 farms and farmers that are waiting to currently be certified. We do this by working directly with farmers, the regulated industry, and interested parties. We have an extremely diverse and talented staff of about 123 full-time equivalents that their careers have been as agronomists, soil scientists, and hydrologists. 40% of this staff live and work in greater Minnesota, and many of these staff have been there for the bulk of their careers. Our staff, extremely well-educated, many of them come from farms and have a farm background. Some of them are also currently active in their family's home farm enterprises. Our budget for our division is about $27 million a year, and most of these dollars come specifically from fees on the sale, or excuse me, fees on the registration of pesticides and fertilizers. The other part of our primary budget comes from Clean Water Fund dollars to address non-point source pollution. Okay. Our regulatory activities include the registration of pesticides and fertilizers. Currently, we register about 13,000 pesticides in the state of Minnesota, and we register about 4,900 fertilizer or fertilizer products within the state. Applicator licensing and the registration of fertilizer dealers is another very significant component of our division's role. We currently register and license almost 30,000 applicators, dealers, and private pesticide applicators. Our complaint, we respond to numerous complaints each year, and as a function of when there's a complaint received, we investigate those, and typically we have about 130 complaints and then subsequent inspections. Facility inspection, the folks in throughout the state that sell agricultural chemicals, we inspect about 75 of these facilities a year. And this is also, I'm relatively new within this division. I've only been here for 2 months. Previously, I was the irrigation specialist for the University of Minnesota. And I was out giving one of my last follow-up, and I had a really large farmer come up and say, oh, well, you're with PFMD. And he said, I wanted to, you know, tell you about the wonderful interaction I had with one of your facilities folks that really gave me straightforward, common sense input in making sure that I was in compliance and I had the safety protocols put into this. So it, you know, when you work in regulatory organizations, it really makes you feel good when you have, you know, growers who don't know you from Adam, but I walk up and say, yeah, I really got a lot of great input from that. So we really feel like we have some excellent staff. Our emergency response to, unit responds to about 130 emergencies per year. And then we're also the division that's responsible for the regulation of anhydrous ammonia. Currently, we've responded to about 42 incidents for anhydrous ammonia and 110 inspections in 2016. Our incident response activities, we're the lead agency for the response to and cleanup of ag chemical spills and contamination within the state of Minnesota. Our activities are directly involved with emergency site cleanup, long-term site cleanups, voluntary cleanups when there might be contamination at a site and the current owner may want to transfer or sell that property. We have voluntary programs that we work with the current owner to fund the remediation of contamination. We do this primarily through our ACRA program, which is our Ag Chemical Response Reimbursement Account. This is the authority laid out in Minnesota Statute 18E. And then we also work through the Minnesota Superfund account, which is commonly referred to as MERLA, which is the Minnesota Environmental Response and Liability Act. And our authority in that is laid out in Minnesota Statute 115B. We're also responsible for addressing the impacts of non-point source pollution. For those of you who may not have been exposed to that term, non-point source pollution is caused by rainfall or snowmelt runoff that moving through or over the ground can carry away naturally occurring or man-made pollutants, and these pollutants could then be deposited to surface or groundwater. Our non-point source activities to groundwater, our authority to address nitrates from fertilizer come from the Groundwater Protection Act, Minnesota Statute 103H. And earlier there had been some questions about the livestock impacts from nitrogen contamination in livestock water. We had some of our staff look into that, and currently from a chronic exposure perspective, it's about 100 parts per million nitrate nitrogen is currently what we consider a chronic threshold for significant impacts to livestock production. At that point, we begin to see milk production decline, herd health decline. Typically, when we talk about chronic nitrate poisoning, we need to see much higher levels than that. Usually, it's about 440 parts per million. And typically, when we see situations like that, it's where livestock have been drinking out of a tank that at one point in time held liquid fertilizer.
Mr. Stamper, about 7 to 8 minutes.
Okay. So we also monitor health and other environmental risks from pesticides. We also conduct water quality monitoring for nitrates and pesticides. As an agency, we seek to make decisions based off of the best available science. A very significant portion of our budget, which I'll cover in just a moment, comes in the form of dollars that we pass through to the University of Minnesota and to other research institutions to help us develop policy and recommendations that are based off of that best available science. Our goal is to protect water resources and support a strong agricultural economy. We involve the agricultural community and different stakeholders in developing practical solutions. We also build relationships and coordinate with other state agencies and programs. Our pesticide non-point activities, as defined in Minnesota Statute 18B, one of the outcomes of that has been the pesticide management plan for water resource protection, and one of the outcomes from that has been the development of pesticide best management practices. To do this, we also conduct product registration of pesticides that are used in the state. Our fertilizer non-point activities is primarily focused around the nitrogen fertilizer management plan to address the contamination of groundwater from nitrates. One of the outcomes of this has been the development of fertilizer best management practices. We also provide technical assistance in the impaired waters process, and we also fund priority research to address gaps in the body of knowledge about this non-point source pollution. We also have the distinction of being one of the few states that certifies soil and manure testing labs. Our water monitoring activities are an integral part of helping us accomplish this. We have a long-term pesticide monitoring network that's been in place for over 25 years. We've pioneered a lot of the techniques that go into edge of field and the monitoring of tile lines to help us get a better handle of the impacts of this. We monitor private wells for nitrate contamination, and we coordinate with other states' monitoring programs to do this. Each year we put out a monitoring report that lists the, throughout our network of testing sites, what we see each year. Our budget, as it's broken out by fund, as you can see from about noon until about 3:30, we have about almost $18 million that come from clean water funds. Our largest component from about 3:30 until about 10 o'clock is our dedicated funds that are coming from fees and surcharges from the registration and sales of products. The next component would be MRLA, which, as I mentioned earlier, is kind of Minnesota's version of the Superfund. And then we also have a component of general fund dollars to the tune of about $1.2 million. And then we have a little under $1 million in federal dollars. Our total biennium budget is a little over $55 million. Our dedicated accounts are broken up into our, from about noon until 6, you'll see the dollars that are generated and go into our pesticide regulatory account. The next component from about 6 until about 7:30 is our ACRA funds, and this is how we address emergency spills in response to contamination of agricultural chemicals. Then moving on from that, we have our fertilizer fund, MRLA projects at about 9 o'clock, and this is the dollars that come from the remediation fund to address significant agriculturally related long-term contamination. And we also have the AFREC dollars, which is our fertilizer research checkoff money. Then we also have dollars that are allocated to the collection of waste pesticides. And then there's also general funds and, again, the federal grants and the dollars that go into the administration of the MRLA dollars. Last slide is our Clean Water Fund appropriations. The first significant portion in blue from noon until about 3 o'clock is our nitrate contamination in groundwater. The next slide from about 3 until 5 o'clock is our technical assistance dollars, where we work with farmers and landowners to conduct a lot of on-farm research to address questions about non-point source contamination. From about 5 o'clock until about 7 o'clock, you'll see the dollars that are appropriate to the Ag Water Quality Certification Program, as I mentioned earlier. And then from 8 o'clock until about 9 o'clock, we have our dollars that go into research. And this is to answer some of the questions, the gaps that we have as we interact with other agencies about filling the knowledge gaps. Then after that, we get into our pesticide monitoring and surface water dollars that are then allocated into the Forever Green Initiative. And then there is $220,000 that funds the irrigation extension specialist at the University of Minnesota. And then lastly, in from about 11 o'clock to 12 o'clock, you'll see the dollars that are spent on pesticides in groundwater and the monitoring activities to support that.
All right, thank you. Ms. Stamper, we do have a couple questions. Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, the department has had a cleanup project going in my district with the agricultural chemical that pesticide that dealt with that arsenic that was used in a manufacturing plant just a couple blocks from my own home. And I believe there were about 3 years of cleanup, and then money ran out, and now I know they're back cleaning up. My neighbor across the street has had some more remediation. And basically what this involves, Mr. Chairman, is they come and take the yards. They took my two side yards and my front yard and scooped it up and took it away to a landfill and brought in some other dirt. And that happened to more than 500 homes in my neighborhood a couple years ago. And I think you're back at doing it again. And I'm wondering if you can't give it to me today, can you give me an update on where we are with that project? I know it involves some federal funds, or did, and MRLA might be part of it as well, and I'm trying to understand what more I can expect in terms of people are asking, are we going to keep having our lawns dug up and so on.
Mr. Stamper.
Mr. Chair, representatives, we will certainly get you an update.
Okay, that's one.
Thank you.
One more question, Mr. Chair, and I don't know how much, I know you don't have much time left, so maybe this is another one to come back on, but does your department, or your part of the agency, deal with the amendments from the municipal biosolids that are being promoted to be used on our farms throughout Minnesota?
Mr. Stamper?
Mr. Chairman, representatives, no.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, what agency does deal with that?
I believe Mr. Stamper or Ms. Place?
Mr. Chair, representatives, I believe that would be the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
Mr. Chairman, I guess if you could just get back to me, because it's marketed as a fertilizer, so that would be helpful.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director Stamper. I like it that the agency is continuing to have good employees working in your division. I think it's had a history of that, Mr. Chair.
Maybe. You want to explain that, right?
I actually do have a question, and maybe it's for both of you. You know, in the last couple of days, there's been discussions about beachhead teams arriving at the EPA and grants being frozen and communication being stifled. And you referenced Merla, and my eyes aren't, even with my glasses, Mr. Chair, I can't quite see which color lines up with Merla and the federal grants. So I'm wondering if we have federal money that's being stopped, that's going to the Ag Department, and what impacts, you know, if you've received money from the federal government or if you need to receive money to keep programs going, or what's the impact of this freeze that's going on now with the federal government?
Stanford. Mr. Chair, representatives, MRLA is primarily funded through Minnesota Statute 116.155, and that remediation fund, I do not know if we get federal dollars for that, but MRLA is kind of our state super fund. I do not know if we have EPA dollars that come from that.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think there's maybe some super fund money that matches into that that comes in, that goes in through ACRA, potentially. Ms. Blaze?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vinson, we'll be sure to have that information for the hearing on Tuesday. All
right. Thank you. Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Stanford, for following up on the nitrate question I had. I heard you say that there can be chronic impacts on animal production, or milk production, I believe it was, with 100 parts per million. Do you see any examples of that in the state?
Stamper.
Mr. Chair, representatives, I know that there was extensive research, and we relied on the input of veterinarians from Iowa State University. I am not familiar with any instance of that in Minnesota.
Representative Johnson.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Any plans to kind of pursue that with milk producers? Because, you know, that it would, my guess is they would like to know that.
We will certainly look in, Mr. Chair, representatives, we will certainly look into it.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you. And then my other question is on the Forever Green. Can you describe the I believe you got $700,000 from the Clean Water Fund supporting the Forever Green initiatives. What is that money spent for?
Mr. Stamper.
Mr. Chair, representatives, this is about $1 million, and Forever Green as a enterprise within the University of Minnesota is looking to develop the next generation of crops that can be grown to keep the soil covered year-round in Minnesota.
Okay. All right. Chair Anderson.
Just a quick one. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Could you give us a quick update? You may not have it offhand, but where your department is or your division is in terms of state approval for that new dicamba chemical for soybeans. EPA has approved it. States have to do it as well. And where are we in that process?
Stamper.
Mr. Chair, representatives, we have submitted some follow-up questions about the registration of the two dicamba products that have been applied for, and currently the ball is in the court of those two companies in responding to our initial questions.
Chair Anderson?
Yeah, just any idea of the timeline, because, you know, spring will be here fairly soon. Farmers need to make decisions on seed and chemicals. May it be here by springtime, do you think, the approval?
Stanford.
Mr. Chair, representatives, we foresee the timeline being between 10 and 40 days.
All right. Chair Anderson?
Okay.
Seeing no other questions, Ms. Place, we have 15 minutes. Do you think we can get in? What's that? We have 15 minutes for the
Chair,
end of the committee.
Mr. Chair, I'm confident we can make it.
Okay.
Next, we'll have our Division Director, Dr. Nicole Nieser of the Dairy and Meat Inspection Division.
All right. Thank you. So welcome, Doctor. Please state your name for the record and begin.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Dr. Nicole Nieser. I'm the Director of Dairy and Meat Inspection Division with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture.
Welcome.
We are the smaller of two food safety-focused divisions at the Department of Agriculture, and our division focuses on animal products, basically. So we're doing dairy, meat, poultry, and eggs. We implement regulatory programs associated with these products. Most of these programs are inspection-based. Also, our programs are intended to ensure that products can be marketed into commerce. For example, dairy products, in order to be sold interstate, grade A dairy products need to be produced in a state with a interstate milk shipment certified program. And so our program serves that function. We provide that inspection service. Likewise, for meat inspection, in order for meat processors to wholesale their product, they need to be produced using an inspection service that allows them to do that. So we provide an important commerce function as well. Our division also responds to emergencies, recalls, and conducts outbreak investigations. Fortunately, due to the strength, I think, of our food safety programs, particularly with these products, that's actually a very small component of our division's work. We accomplish our work through several strategies. Most of our work is inspection-based, using on-site, in-person inspections. Our inspections are designed to ensure that products are being handled safely at the manufacturing plants and on farms, that our facilities are sanitary, and that plants are implementing food safety systems and preventative measures that are addressing our relevant and current food safety risks. We also collect samples. So in fiscal year 2015 and 16, we collected over 5,300 dairy product samples, as well as 2,700 meat and poultry product samples. Many of these samples are required statutorily or by rule for collection and for testing for food safety pathogens. We use this to monitor how well our plants are doing, as well as how well our inspection is doing to address the current risks. Our overall approach to inspection really is education first and regulation second. So we invest a significant amount of time in working with our processors and farmers and helping them meet the regulations, as well as prospective or new business owners and trying to help them navigate the complex world that dairy and meat inspection regulations can be. So we invest a significant amount of time trying to provide guidance. The industries that we regulate are industries that operate 24/7, and a lot of the inspections that are required can happen at a moment's notice and a weekend. A lot of times we may not be available to do that, and so in the past 3 years we've implemented two certified industry inspection programs where we train industry personnel to conduct basic inspections that help them meet inspection requirements, lots of times just for the short term until we can get there, or in times where we're unable to get there. So if, for example, for tanker inspections, a lot of tankers move on weekends and in the middle of the night, and we're just not staffed to do that. And it's a win-win for us to have people at these operations that are trained in food safety and that can look for inspection, conduct those inspections, and meet our regulatory frequencies, as well as have them be knowledgeable in food safety. We also issue certificates for export for Minnesota dairy and meat inspection products. Our food division also issues those inspection certificates. So we do certificates of free sale and animal health certification certificates. Our division has a budget of a little over $12 million. Our major funding sources are the general fund, the agricultural fund or fees, as well as some federal monies that we receive for meat inspection. This supports 53.4 FTEs. We work very hard to cross-train our employees, especially our support functions. To give you a little bit of idea of how much work we accomplish with this, we do have 14.25 FTEs for field inspectors in the dairy program. They cover the whole state. They conducted 8,800 inspections last year. We have 16 field inspectors for meat inspection. They conduct over 11,000. So we average over 600 to 650 inspections per inspector, which is very significant given that inspections may be as short as 30 minutes, but they also might be as long as several days. So, we do get around. Our inspectors do travel quite a lot. The rest of our staff consists of compliance officers, operations and support, outreach staff,
specialized auditors, veterinary support, as well as supervisors and managers. All right, I'm just going to talk briefly about our two major programs. Dairy inspection is one of our, obviously, our major program, a very old inspection program, and we're responsible for inspecting everything from the farm to the manufacturing plant. So in Minnesota, as of January 1st, we had a little over 3,200 dairy farms. 3,026 of these were grade A farms, and 232 were grade B farms. We continue to have a small segment of those grade B farms, and one of the primary drivers of that is an increase in goat farms. So we're seeing definitely a trend for more goat farms, and those all land in that grade B category for the most part. We do see continue to see farm numbers decrease. However, milk production has been stable, so we're seeing fewer farms, bigger farms, generally speaking. We're also seeing an increased number of plants, so we're seeing a lot of interest in small dairy processors, particularly with cheese and ice cream production. And so we are now up to 62 manufacturing plants as well as 30 grade A plants. So we have a very strong manufacturing dairy industry. We also oversee the distribution and the transport of milk. So we're doing tanker inspections, as I mentioned. We did conduct 405 tanker inspections in calendar year 2016. That just includes the ones we conduct, not the ones that the industry has conducted as part of the certified industry tanker program. And then we also license 900 hauler samplers. So those are haulers that pick up milk on farms and sample milk. Our budget for the dairy inspection program is about $6.8 million over the biennium. 35% of this comes from general fund, and 65% of this comes from fees that are paid by processors for the most part, as well as, processors being people who procure milk, companies that procure milk from farms, as well as companies that sell products in Minnesota. As I mentioned, some of our trends are more plants. So we're seeing fewer farms, but we are seeing more plants, and so we're seeing more work associated with those plants, as well as increase definitely in the goat milk production segment. And with respect to our meat inspection program, Minnesota has a, we call this the State Equal To Meat Inspection Program, and it's called Equal To because it's equal to that of USDA. So a meat processor, if they want to sell their meat or poultry products wholesale, so not to the end consumer, they have to have a certain type of inspection service, and they can basically choose between USDA inspection service, which will allow them to sell their products across state lines, or state inspection service, which would allow them to sell their products within the state of Minnesota. This is purely a marketing thing. The food safety requirements are the same as USDA, and that's one of the reasons why we call it equal to USDA. This inspection service is a high intensity inspection, so these plants are getting inspected daily. Every time they process under inspection, we have an inspector there at some point during that day, not for the entire day, but at some point during the day. And if they're slaughtering animals, we have an inspector there looking at every animal before and after slaughter to make sure all of the meat and organs from that animal are safe and healthy and can be sold into commerce. And so those are long inspection days, so we may be at a plant for an entire day when we're doing that. We also have a custom-exempt inspection program where we're conducting facility inspections at what we call custom meat processors. These are processors. A lot of times people think of these as their local butchers, but they're processors that process. They provide a service to farmers traditionally. So a farmer brings their cow to the plant or their animal to the plant, and they butcher it for them, and then the farmer takes that product home. That product is marked not for sale because it cannot be sold. It hasn't had an inspector look at it. It is not intended for retail or wholesale. This kind of process has been expanded in recent years to include direct marketing of halves and quarters of beef. And so as long as you own the animal before it goes to the meat processor, you can use this kind of service, as well as a number of what we call live animal markets, markets where people go, pick their animal out, buy it at the market, and have it slaughtered right there on site. So our budget is about $5 million over the biennium, and this is approximately a 50-50 split with USDA. So the federal fund is about 50% of what we get for that. We do have some challenges with timing of that money and how the federal budgets are allocated and when they're allocated, and so it does vary a little bit from year to year, and that's why this chart shows a little 45-55 right now, but it just depends on the timing of the money. I did put a little bit of a update on there in terms of the plant numbers. So we right now we're sitting at 57 equal to plants, which is the highest we've been for several years. And in calendar year 2016, we added 6 new plants, which is a substantial number of plants for us to add, knowing that we're at these plants every single day that they process. And we're expecting 10 additional plants. We have 10 actually in the pipeline with several more that are a little farther away from coming under inspection. And we did receive money in the last biennium to help support this expansion of services. We're probably also near, with that additional 10, we're getting to the limits of our capacity again, which is great because we're really seeing a lot of interest in the meat inspection program. Particularly from the ethnic perspective and different kinds of cultural operations.
Dr. Kneeser, we have about 4 minutes before the committee is over, and we have 2 questions.
All right.
Right? Otherwise, we can invite you back next week, too. But
Mr. Chair, I'm just about finished, okay. So we're good. As I mentioned, our inspections are required for safety as well as for commerce. And actually, my last slide is just an overview of some of the other programs that our division administers, which are all very small programs. Probably of most interest is the Northeastern Regional Correctional Institute Butcher Pilot Training Program Coordination, which is a general fund program, and there's a legislative report that will be coming out on that soon. So, and that would be my presentation. Well, so I'm willing to take questions.
Thank you, Dr. Kneeser. And on that that training program, we actually got really creative with the name last legislative session. That was Representative Metza that carried that bill. But none of us wanted to pass out of here, the butchers affiliated with the prisons, et cetera. So we got, with Representative Metza's leadership, we got clever on the name around that. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Dr. Leeser. Just a couple of quick questions. Let's make sure that I understand. The number of milk processing plants in the state of Minnesota is 30. Is that the right number?
Dr. Leeser.
Mr. Chair and Representative, there are 30 grade A milk processing plants. And so grade A plants refers to those plants that produce what we call fluid milk products. So that's bottled milk, yogurt, cottage cheese, and sour cream, basically.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Dr. Leeser. When I took office about 2003, I believe there were 6,000 to 7,000 dairy farms in Minnesota. And now that we have about 3,200. In that time period, roughly, what has happened to milk production in Minnesota?
Dr. Kneeser.
Mr. Chair and Representative, milk production has been very stable. So we've reduced the number of farms, but generally our farms are either larger or cows are producing more milk.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, and Dr. Leeser, do we have approximately the same number of cows, or are they just working harder?
Dr. Kneeser.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I'm not sure offhand exactly what the numbers are. I would have to actually look up the exact number of cows.
Representative Erdahl?
Minnesota Milk will be here next week.
Okay. All right, we'll ask Minnesota Milk. With that, I don't see any other questions. I want to thank the department for your testimony. Members, just a reminder, next week we'll continue with the presentation on the budget. Please leave your folders here. We'll just use those for the next meeting as well. And, again, thank you for the testimony. We are adjourned.